All right, good evening, everyone. Let's begin. I really want to begin by thanking, you know, our shul. Baruch Hashem is very privileged to have many, many wonderful and incredible members who give of their time, who give of their resources. And each month we have a Talmud Torah sponsor, families who dedicate all of the shiurim and drushas of a particular month. And this month of Kislev, we're very privileged to have two mishpachos, two families dedicating all the shiurim and drushas. Josh and Becca Friedman, Le'iloi Nishmas, Josh's father, Yisrael Yehuda ben Rav Chaim Rafal, on the occasion of his first yard site, at the Sammy and Malka Estherson, Le'iloi Nishmas, their parents, Yitzchak Le ben Aaron HaKohen, Sarah Rachel Bas Baruch, and Hinda Bas Henach Ephraim. Hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, the Neshamas will have an Aliyah and the families in Nechama. And with that, let us begin. So I'm going to open, there are sheets up here if anyone needs, I'm assuming they went around. I'll open with two interesting observations. The first is, you know, throughout the years, we've done different series. And I find it very interesting that today I received a number of emails from people apologizing that they won't be able to make it tonight. And I thought it was fascinating. I guess people feel the need to apologize if they come to the first part of a Shalom Bayashir and don't come to the second one. You know, what does that look like if you don't show up for the second installment of the Shalom Bayashir? So it was cute to see how people, the sensitivity, but also I think because it's a topic that, I'm not going to use the word that we struggle with Chas V'Shalom, because it's not a struggle, it's a privilege to work on a marriage, and it's a privilege to nurture a relationship. The other observation was, you know, the Gemara talks about the idea that Rava used to go ahead and open up all of his discourses, his lectures, his shiurim, his drushas, b'milsa b'dichusa, with a joke. And the goal of the joke, of course, was to lighten the mood a little bit, to put people in a, not a jocular frame of mind, but just to kind of break the ice a little bit, to make things a little bit easier, and to make the learning atmosphere a little bit enjoyable. So I had a couple of stories that I was going to start with tonight. And then I realized something very interesting, which is, almost every single marriage story and joke always has, often have, a cynical underpinning. Meaning that a lot of marriage humor is very sarcastic, right? And a lot of marriage humor, right, is ultimately, again, speaking about, you know, loss of autonomy, loss of control, loss of free choice, all those different things. And it struck me, you know, people make jokes for different reasons. Sometimes people make jokes because they have good sense of humor. More often than not, people use humor as a way of diffusing sometimes tension-filled situations. And I think when it comes to discussing marriage, there is so much that is rolled into this discussion of marriage. We call this Shalom Bayis. So what does Shalom Bayis mean? Shalom Bayis means so many different things to so many different people. And again, it represents our relationship, it represents the couple unit, it represents individuals. There's so much rolled into this that almost as if our reflexive reaction when talking about marriage is to be a bit cynical or a bit jocular or a bit joking in nature, almost in order to diffuse a little bit of the intensity that marriage really brings with it. So, I'm not going to start with a story. Instead, what we're going to do is we're going to start with an incredible medrash. If you look at number one, and actually it's in Yonah and Diyoma, I also feel a little bit awkward and humble as we have amongst us tonight a clinician that I feel is probably amongst the best. Dr. Gail Goldberg is here with us, and she should be the one really giving the class, not me. And really, on behalf of our community, I thank Dr. Goldberg for all the incredible things that she's done for so many throughout our community. Thank you. So with that, let's take a look at the Medrash. Right, so Medrash number one. Amar Rava. Rava said as follows. Pshitali ner Chanukah v'kiddush hayom ner Chanukah adif. So again, the Medrash begins with a very simple halachic discussion. What happens if a person has limited funds? Limited funds. So I have enough money to do one of two things. Either to purchase Chanukah candles or to purchase wine for Kiddush. Those are my choices. So what's the halacha? Ner Chanukah adif. Right? You have to use your funds for Ner Chanukah, for Chanukah candles. Why? Mishum pirsumi nisa. Because Chanukah candles are the way that we go ahead and we publicly publicize the miracle. this, without getting into all the halachic technicalities over here, but the essence of Hanukkah candles is broadcasting the miracle to the general public. Therefore, again, says the Gemara, when you have a tension between a personal mitzvah and a public mitzvah, the public mitzvah wins out. Kiddush Hayom, Efshar Demekadesh Shrifta. Furthermore, again, you could always make Kiddush on Challah. What about Ner Hanukkah, V'Ner Beiso? What happens if you have limited funds and you could only buy, you only have enough money to purchase Hanukkah candles or Shabbos candles? So which ones ultimately do you purchase, says the Gemara? They're based so adif, you purchase Shabbos candles. Why? Mishum Shalom Bayis. Because ultimately, again, why do we light Shabbos candles? We light Shabbos candles because of Shalom Bayis. Now, by the way, I know it's beautiful, sounds wonderful. It's actually very practical and utilitarian. Why do you light Shabbos candles? Because, again, to see. Otherwise, if it's dark and you slam your toe against the wall, nothing removes Shalom Bayis faster than a broken toe. So on a most basic level, in order to have a normal functional Shabbos, you need illumination. But the Gemara discusses something fascinating. So there's a tension over here between the Hanukkah candles and the Shabbos candles. I only have enough for one. Hanukkah candles, you should know, are so important that the Shulchan Aruch says that you literally have to go ahead and sell the shirt off your back, like Dalet Kos, like the 4 cups of wine for Pesach. That's how important Hanukkah candles are, because it's a public display, it's a public celebration. And yet, when there's a tension between Shabbos candles and Hanukkah candles, Shabbos candles win. Why? Because the most important thing in your life is your Shalom Bayis. Because at the end of the day, what goes on inside of your home is much more important than the image you project outside of your home. And this is incredibly important because I think many of us, consciously or subconsciously, often live that in the reverse. We put so much time and effort into our external appearances, our external images, and sometimes devote so few resources to the Shabbos candles on the inside. There are plenty of seats. Please feel free to come. You can walk right through here. And so we devote so much time to the externalities and not enough time to the things that are internal. But yet the Medrash tells us that the Shabbos candles take precedence over. In simple ways, by the way, I'm not going to take a show of hands, but I would venture to say that if you think back in your life to the time that you spoke most disrespectfully to someone, chances are it was who? Oh, good. See, Moshe has been married long enough. He's brave enough to answer that question. Right? Your spouse. It's an incredible thing. When you're young, it's usually your parents. But as you get older, it's almost always your spouse. Almost always your spouse. How could it be? I would never say things to a complete stranger that I would say to my spouse. I would never let loose on a complete... So it's an amazing thing. Because so often in life, we're so focused on the Hanukkah candles. We're so focused on the externalities. We're so focused on the images that we project, which I want to point out are very important. But yet the halacha tells us that Shalom Bayis, your Shabbos candles, your internal identity, the relationship you build with your spouse, is so much more important than any external relationship you have. So when it comes to Shalom Bayis, we often define Shalom Bayis, I think, in a very erroneous way. That we define Shalom Bayis, right? If I were to ask you, what's the definition of Shalom Bayis?
Peace in the
peace in the home. Okay, that was low-lying fruit. What do you think? What's Shalom Bayis?
Successful relationship.
What's the problem with that definition? It's totally ambiguous and amorphous, which is why it was very safe. Excellent, godly. Excellent, good. Right? How else would you define Shalom Bayis?
Marital bliss.
Excellent. Okay. Good. Becca, you heard? Good. Fine. Noted. Good. Excellent. How else do we define Shalom Bayis?
Healthy relationship.
So it's funny because usually when I've given a Shalom Bayis series in other settings, often the first answer that's given is the absence of conflict. Right? Shalom Bayis. Shalom means peace. Peace on the most basic level means the absence of conflict. And this is a very dangerous definition. Because if you define Shalom Bayis as the absence of conflict, then my dear friends, we are all in serious trouble. because there is no marriage, there is no home, there is no relationship between two people that is without conflict. And by the way, here's the other piece. That word conflict itself has a negative connotation. Conflict is not negative. Conflict just means differences of opinion. Conflict just means two different people. Conflict just means that me and my spouse are not necessarily on the same page. That could be bad if allowed to escalate, as we'll discuss. But in its essence, the notion of conflict is not bad. And I'll tell you something amazing. You know, the commentaries on Bereishis all ask the same fundamental question, which is, why do you need the first book of the Torah at all? Right? Remember, again, the Torah is not a storybook. The Torah is a book of laws. And even the stories that are mentioned are only there because of their legal, ethical, or moral implications. And yet, when you look at Bereishis, there's virtually no halacha contained in Sefer Bereishis. No law that's really actively learned out. All right, period of Rivia procreation is learned out from Bereishis. Even Bris Milah is not learned out from Bereishis. Bris Milah is mentioned again in Chumash Vayikra, Gid Hanoshen, not even the sciatic nerve, perhaps a reference to the concept of Shiva, of mourning. But there are no laws that are learned out in Bereishis. So why does the Torah tell us all of these stories? Because these stories are laden with so much meaning for how we build our lives. So you want to speak about the fact that conflict is part and parcel of marriage. One doesn't have to look to their parents or their grandparents. You could look at the avos and the imos. Look at the patriarchs and matriarchs. Take a look at number two. The Torah says, Vayeda Adam od es ishto. Adam knew his wife. A reference, remember, knowing is the biblical metaphor for intimacy. Vatelad bein vatikra shmo sheis. Just to give you context, this verse, this pasuk is written after Cain killed Hevel, actually a number of years already afterwards, and Adam and Chava have a child together. Rashi is struck by the verbiage, Vayeda Adam od es ishto. Adam again knew his wife, and Rashi says something amazing. V'alo parashta mi'ishtecha zeh mea ushloshim shana. Adam and Chava separated from one another physically. They did not have an intimate relationship for 130 years. For 130 years. After they were expelled from the Garden of Eden, after that entire debacle, amplified by the killing of Cain, of Cain killing Hevel, they separated from each other. They separated. Whatever that separation was about, whether it was the pain of failure, the pain of shattered dreams, failed as parents, whatever it might be, but they had, there was some conflict, and that conflict drove them away, drove them apart from each other for 130 years. Number four, the Torah says, Avram and Sarah, Vatomer la'Avram garish es ha'amazos ves'bino, kilo yirash es ben ha'amazos ibnim Yitzchak. A dramatic episode. Avram now has two sons, Yishmael from Hagar and Yitzchak from Sarah. Sarah Iminu is unhappy with the influence that Yishmael is having on young Yitzchak and therefore tells Avram, you need to send him away. You need to send him out of the familial home. You need to get rid of him. Avram Avinu is exceptionally troubled. Vayera hadavar ma'od be'ene Avram alo dos b'no. Avram was very troubled. Remember, what was Avram Avinu's mission in this world? What was his mission? I'm sorry? To have a son. But what was his greater mission in the world? To spread monotheism, right? Avram Avinu was all about bringing people closer, bringing people into the tent. And now my wife is telling me that I have to get rid of my own flesh and blood. I go out and try to convert the world. And now my own son, you want me to kick out of the house? And Avram Avinu, again, who is normally a very loving, acquiescing husband, it's clear, says no. Says no. How do we know he says no? Vayomer Elokim el Avram, al yira be'inecha lanar va'al amasecha. Kol asher tamar elecha sara shma bekola. How do you know that Avram said no? Or at least, I don't know that he articulated no, but at least in his mind, did not really have in mind to comply with Sarah's wishes, because God intervenes. And God says, you have to listen to her. So Adam and Chava have conflict. Avram and Sarah have conflict. And the conflict goes on. Number five. Vayehav Yitzchak es Esav kitzayid befiv v'rifka oheves es Yaakov. As they say, ein conflict gidol mizo. What incredible marital conflict. Two parents playing favorites. Two parents playing favorites, right? Yitzchak is connected to Esav. Rivka is connected ultimately again to Yaakov. And remember, this story snowballs. What happens? So Rivka is the one who encourages her younger son Yaakov to masquerade as his older brother and to, quote-unquote, steal the blessings. There was conflict. Yitzchak and Rivka were not on the same page. I'll tell you something absolutely amazing. Rav Shamshon Yuval Hirsch, I meant to actually put this on the sheet, I apologize, but you'll look it up. Rav Shamshon Yuval Hirsch says something that is mind-blowing. In fact, many people kind of ostracized Rabbi Hirsch for saying this. Now you for sure want to hear it, right? So he said as follows. He said, why did Rivka tell Yaakov to masquerade as Esav? It's such a weird plan. First of all, blessings aren't something that you could simply go ahead and just steal. Right? Oh, if I show up, Rav Chaim Kanievsky is about to give you a bracha, and I shove you out of the way, and I stand in front of him. Ah, Gishmak, right? I got the bracha. It doesn't work that way. So what did Rivka hope to accomplish? And Rav Hirsch says something amazing. He says, Rivka was telling Yitzchak for years, you don't understand the kids. You don't understand the kids. You're a big tzaddik. You don't understand normal people. And so you think Yitzchak you think Esav is a big tzaddik. You're wrong. He's deceiving you. And what does Yitzchak say? I know my children. No one could pull the wool over my eyes. And this conversation goes on for years until Rivka Imenu is faced with no option but to show her husband how easily he can be deceived. A couple of skins and a tray of food, and suddenly you think that your younger son is your older son. So you see, my beloved husband, you don't know as much as you think. Conflict. Incredible conflict. Conflict goes on. Number 6. Vatera Rachel Kilo Yoda, in a dramatic pasuk, Rachel Imenu saw that she had not given birth. Vatekani Rachel Ba'achosa. Rachel became jealous of her sister of Leah. Vatomer El Yaakov, Havali Banim, Ve'im Ayin Mesa Anochi. Rachel says to Yaakov, give me children. And if you don't give me children, I'm as good as dead. So what's Yaakov's response? Vayichar Af Yaakov B'Rachel. Yaakov gets angry at Rachel. Vat Yomer, he says, Hatachas Elokim Anochi? Am I God? Am I God? Hashem mana mimich pribaten? So you know, Rashi, you know what Yaakov was saying to Rachel? It's not my problem. It's your problem. It's your problem. I have children. So whatever's going on over here, it's you. I'm not God. And you know, the Gemara says, V'kach, is this how you speak to a barren woman? Is this how you speak to a woman struggling with fertility? This is your wife. This was your Bashir. This was the woman you wanted to marry. She's coming to you with a broken heart and you lash out at her. So you all know, you ever have an exchange with someone where you say something that is seemingly innocuous or not that severe and you get like a tidal wave of emotion coming back at you. So how do you usually understand that type of that reaction? Never happens to anyone. Baruch Hashem. Okay, happens to me like a number of times a day. Hey, so normally the way you understand that is, wow, you're really having a bad day. I'm sorry you're having such a bad day because that is not a normal reaction. The way you're reacting to me does not conform to what our nature of our discussion, to the nature of our dialogue. If you're talking that way, it must mean that something else is churning inside of you. Do you want to talk about it? Do you want to discuss it? Or otherwise, you know what? Let's reconvene. Let's reconnect at a different time. Rachel comes to Yaakov, bearing her soul. I feel like I'm dead. I feel like I'm dead. And what does Yaakov even say? It's not my problem. It's not me. What's for dinner? You know, what do you want from me? This is Yaakov Avinu, which tells you that there was something else happening over here. Each of these discussions and each of these interactions highlight some level of conflict. And the reason I'm bringing this up is to show you that conflict is part and parcel of a marital union. You know, I mentioned this in my Talmud shiur last week, my Wednesday morning shiur, that a little while ago, I got a call from a young woman who had gotten married. It was during her Sheva Brachas. And she called me up and she was very agitated. She said, Rabbi Silber, we have a real emergency. Can we come in and meet with you? I said, of course. And of course, a couple calls up during Sheva Brachas. Who knows, you know, what's going to be. So they come in, and you know, I mentioned this before, it was one of these conversations, you know, like, you ever try to speak to someone when they're very emotionally worked up? So she said, well, and then it was like sobbing, but it was words interspersed with sobbing. So like, hey, man. And no idea what she's saying. The husband is also like shaking his head. So finally she composed herself. I said, what happened? She said, we had a fight. I said, okay. And what? We had a fight. So I thought, okay, maybe I missed something. I only had 7 cups of coffee that morning. So like, maybe I missed something. She said, no, it was the second day of Shavuot Brachos, and we had a fight. How could our marriage survive this? What's going to happen? So I had to contain myself a little bit from like, oh, you're so cute. Because I knew that would not have been helpful. But what was incredible to see is that whoever had taught this young girl and this young man did not give them proper perspective on marriage. Because someone taught them that blissful marriage, like Gavi was talking about before, means the absence of conflict. The only type of marriage where there is an absence of conflict is no marriage. Wherever there is marriage and wherever there is two people trying to build a life together, there is always going to be conflict. And that is why the Torah HaKadosha goes out of its way to tell us these stories. The Torah needs to tell me that Adam and Chava separated for 130 years? That Avram and Sarah didn't agree about what to do about Yishmael? That Yitzchak and Rivka didn't agree on the kids? That Yaakov didn't know how to speak to Rachel in her time of need? Yes, the Torah needs to tell us. To tell us why? That even the best of marriages, and even most normal marriages, always have a healthy dose of conflict. Because whenever you have two different people trying to build a life together, no matter how many shared dreams and aspirations they have, they're two different people. And when you have two different people living under the same roof, God willing, until 120, ultimately, again, conflict is their lifelong companion. But what type of conflict are we referring to? So if you take a look at number 7, Rav Shragi Neuberger from Ner Yisrael wrote a beautiful sefer on Shalom Bayis. The name of the sefer is called Yoatzei Shalom. It's a small little sefer in Hebrew, comprised of a series of different shiurim given to chassanim. And he writes about, he has a section here about conflict. So he says something amazing. I just wanted to quote it to you in his words. Number 7. V'hine, kishenizbonin b'chilukim shebein ish li'isha, nimtza al pirov sheish b'ikar gimel sugim shonim. So this is great. There are 3 primary areas of conflict. Now, when we say primary, what does primary mean? Right? It means that there are secondary, right? So what this means is, so again, he's trying to say, obviously, there are many areas of conflict, and people have different areas of conflict. But if you wanted to condense conflict into major groupings, you could condense them into 3 major groupings. What are they? And each category of conflict requires its own avoda. Hasuga rishon, haynu tivim shonim sheyesh bein zecharim unikevus. The first source of conflict is biological. Men and women are different. I might love my wife to pieces, but I will never understand women. Right? And again, a wife might love her husband to pieces. She will never fully understand a man. On a very simple level, we are distinct biological entities that are driven by different things, that are motivated by different things, and the truth is, often want dramatically different things out of life. There are different things that provide men with happiness, that provide women with happiness. There are different things that allow men to feel complete, that allow women to feel complete. So the first area of conflict is the notion that we're men and women. We're two different beings with different needs, with different desires, with different wants, with different aspirations. I don't even mean this on an individual couple. I mean this kind of like at the 10,000 feet level. Men and women are different. So by definition, because of those differences, that's the first area of conflict. Hasuga sheni, the second area. Chilik mishpachos usivivos shonos. Second area of conflict, mishpacha. Right? Family. Family. Right? We spoke about this a little bit last week as well. Right? A husband grows up in one family. A wife grows up in a different family. And we say family. Family is not just your parents and your siblings. Family is your community. Family is the norms in which you grew up in. That's also a source of conflict. So you have two people coming from two different families, two different backgrounds, sometimes two different cultures, sometimes two different geographic areas, sometimes two literally different socioeconomic religious levels. And you're putting them together in one bliss, intendedly, hopefully, blissful marriage. That's a source of conflict. Different mishpachas. Number three, v'sug ha'shlishi, hu heich lehisnaik im ha'chisrono shemotzim kol echa b'vnei zugo. The third area of conflict is dealing with your spouse's deficiencies. Every person has deficiencies. Every person has weaknesses. Every person has not just an Achilles heel, but multiple Achilles heels, right? All of us have our areas of weakness. And part of conflict in marriage is when you get to know someone's weakness, how do you deal with the deficiencies in your spouse? So let's spend a little bit of time speaking about these three categories. So again, Rabbi Neuberger is positing that conflict arises from three basic sources. Number one, inherent differences between men and women. Number two, differences in familial background. And again, I'm using familial background in the broadest terms. And number three, personality deficiencies or character deficiencies that we each have, how to live with the deficiencies of the other. So let's navigate through these areas of conflict a little bit. So how do we deal with the inherent differences between men and women? What would you suggest? How do you deal with, nobody wants to answer this one, right? How do you deal with the inherent differences between men and women?
Men deal with it one way and women deal with it another way.
Well said. Wow. Okay, 2 points for the word of Shimes tonight. You're like our MVP couple. Excellent. I would say what Devorah is saying just a little bit differently, which is accept that men and women think differently. So many times conflict comes about because I don't understand how you don't see what I'm saying. Which is really what that means is, I don't understand why you don't agree with me, right? I am the beacon of eternal truth, right? I know everything. Mamish, it's like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Moshe Rabbeinu, and me. So I don't understand. And you're Mamish, you're lucky, like I lifted you up and brought you into my life. How can you not see what I'm seeing? So remember, this goes back to what we learned last week also, about seeing things through different windows, right? There's the driver's side window. There's the passenger side window. There are different windows in life. So the first thing we have to do is accept the fact that men and women think differently. I'll give you two examples of this. I was having a conversation with someone this past week. Actually, it wasn't like a shalom bayis. It just came up, and I don't even know how it came to this. But he told me, he said, you know, I've developed a new shita. I've developed a new principle in life. I said, no, I love to hear people's shitas. Oh, a lot of shita. Right, let me hear. He says, I don't buy flowers for my wife anymore on Erev Shabbos. I said, okay, tell me more. He said, you know, I thought about it. I did it for a while. And he said, you know, it's at least $15, $20 for a nice bouquet. They stay fresh maybe for a day, two. And by Sunday already, again, I can see my wife really wants to throw them out, but she doesn't want to upset me or hurt my feelings. So it's just not worth it. It's just not worth it. So I said, okay, I said, tell me, how's that working out? He's like, you know, I don't know, my wife doesn't seem to agree with me about it. I'm like, wow, what a shocker. But here was something so fascinating. See, what the man was saying, first of all, I just want to point out, men, you must buy your wife flowers every single Erev Shabbos. That is a non-negotiable detail. Whether you call yourself a romantic, not a romantic, it has nothing to do with romance. It has to do with being a proper husband. A woman works hard to make Shabbos. Whether she's working hard in the home and out of the home, just out of the home and someone else is making Shabbos, so much of the home rests upon the shoulders of an Akeres HaBayis, of the woman of the house. And the least a husband could do is to pick up flowers. And by the way, not Trader Joe flowers. They've got to be wrapped nicely as well, right? If you're going to buy Trader, you could rewrap it, right? No, come on. Let's say, a husband has to bring home wife. So again, I just want to put that out. I want to go on record, right? Torah misina, a man must buy flowers for his wife. You're not too busy. You're not too important. You're not above that. It's not that our relationship transcends flowers. Your relationship doesn't transcend anything, right? Buy flowers, buy gifts. Those tokens are incredibly important. But what was incredible to me about this conversation was the idea that here the man was thinking in a very concrete way. Well, how is he looking at this? I'm going to buy the flowers. What's the ROI, right? What's the return on investment on these flowers, right? So I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to buy flowers, I'm going to spend money, I'm going to spend time, because it's not just money. I have to get to the florist or to wherever, I have to come after this. Is it really worth it? And the truth is, when you look at it from an analytical perspective, it may be that it's not so worth it. But here's the amazing part. Understand that your wife probably doesn't think the way you think. So when you walk in the house, you're thinking, okay, here are the beautiful flowers, good Shabbos, I'll see them in the garbage on Sunday, right? And she's thinking, wow, that was really nice. It's really nice. Thank you for thinking of me. Thank you for taking time out of your day to acknowledge the fact that I'm important, that I do things for you, that I do things for the family. Thank you. I guarantee you, the wife is not thinking about, oh, this is going to give me 2 days of aesthetic enjoyment, and then it's going in the garbage. She's thinking in that moment, my husband values me enough to be able to do something nice. It's a token act, but it's meaningful. I'll give you another example of this. Just the differences that men and women think. This, I learned this early on. When we were first married, I was learning in Kollel at Yeshiva University. And a long, long time ago, Baruch Hashem, we just celebrated our 23rd anniversary. I was learning in Kollel, and we had, in those days, we had one car. So I don't know if they make it anywhere, but do you remember they used to have like a Toyota Tercel? Yeah. Remember this car? Look, it's like, mom's like from the Flintstones. Like, I don't even know that it had like a gas pedal. Like, you just pushed it. So Viva would have the car on Sundays, and she would pick me up after afternoon Seder, and we would drive home together. And she asked me what we were learning. I think we were only married a couple of months at the time. She asked me what we were learning. And without getting into all technicalities, we were learning Maseches Nida in the Kollel. And specifically, we're learning about the Perek of Hamapelas, which we just did in Daf Yomi not so long ago, which speaks at the halachos of when a woman miscarries. All the different halachos of miscarriage. And what type of miscarriage triggers Tumas Leida. So my wife asks me, like, and this is like, you know, we were newlyweds, so we only talked Torah. You know, Baruch Hashem, it was mamish, it was beautiful. I get in the car, the first thing, what did you learn? That's all you learned. I'm so disappointed. I managed to marry a gadol, the chizuk, and it was mamish. It was beautiful. So she asked me what I learned. And I remember this, like, yesterday, like, I launched into, like, a whole cheer about, well, if the woman miscarries something that looks like a baby, then this, but if it doesn't look like a baby, and it's a bit, then I'm going on and on and on. And I turn over, and my wife is pale. Is pale. She's like, I don't understand. How could the rabbis be so concerned with what it is that she miscarried when this woman just had a traumatic event? I was like, what's for dinner? But it was an incredible eye-opening experience, because here the truth is, I thought to myself, wow, like, why did I never think of that? Why did that thought never dawn on me? Never in a million years did I ever think about the woman being discussed in the Gemara as anything more than a technical case, right? It's not talking about Leah this or Rachel this. It's talking about a hypothetical case. But never in a million years did I infuse any level of empathy or compassion into what it is that I was learning. For me, it was an intellectual experience. I was learning Torah. That's what I was involved in. There was a halachic case, a halachic construct to create the halachic principle. Never did I think about anyone's feelings. And that's what it means when there's a difference between men and women. There's a difference in the way we approach things. There's a difference in the way we look at issues. There's a difference in the way we look at the world. There's even a difference in the way we look at a piece of Gemara. There's a difference. And this area of conflict is not one, and I want to point this out as well, not all conflicts are resolvable. We'll get into that in just a little bit. But the idea is, the differences between men and women are significant, acute, and not going away anytime soon. So we only way to deal with it is to understand it and to accept it. I love my wife very much, but I do not think the way she thinks, and she does not think the way that I think. I don't need to think the way that she thinks because that's part of who she is. As a person, as a woman, she doesn't need to think the way I think because that's who I am as a man and as an individual. The next area, appreciating conflict that comes about because of differences in family. So this is very interesting. So I don't even know how much this actually requires so much definition. I see a lot of nods and smiles, so I think everybody gets this. But this is incredibly important. You know, a lot of times it's important to realize when you grow up in a family, that becomes your normal. That becomes your normal, right? So you assume that the way you're brought up is kind of like similar to the way that everybody else is growing up. It's only when we get older and we begin to see the world in a little bit more of a panoramic view that we begin to see that my parents are not like these parents, not like these parents, and my home life and my family life and maybe the values I were brought up with or maybe the things that were important to me ultimately, again, are not important or are more important to other families. And so a lot of times when two people come together, they might love each other very much. But remember, again, we are each a composite of our life circumstances. So I am a composite of the life circumstances that I grew up with. And so if someone else grew up with a different set of circumstances, then ultimately, again, they're going to have a different outlook on life. So once again, what we have to try to do in this situation, so Rabbi Neuberger in his Sefer gives a very simple mashal. He says, if you could imagine two people get married, man and woman get married, and in the man's family, so they always ate on dishes, even during the week. Always dishes and flatware, no paper plates, no paper cups, everything, you know, sitting and down and eating is a chashuv thing. It's important, right? It's a form of avodas Hashem, serving Kodesh Baruch Hu as well. It's family time. It has a chashivus, and so we use plates, cups, flatware. The wife grew up in a home where, okay, week Shabbos, of course you use dishes, but weekday, everything plastic, paper, set up for dinner in 3 minutes, clear off from dinner in 33 seconds, shalom al Yisrael. So what happens? Couple gets married. Husband assumes that what are they going to be eating on? Plates. Wife assumes what are they going to be eating on? Paper plates, right? And here we have conflict. The husband says, what is this? Paper plates? What are we like peasants? Right? What's going on over here? How do you? This is not a suda, right? This is not the pizza store, right? This is a home. This is a bayis. This is our mikdash mat. A suda has to, even during the week, has to be beautiful. The wife says, "Oh, we can imagine what the wife says." The wife says, "Good. You could be the melech in the kitchen also. Right? Go ahead, please put all the dishes you want." Right? So what happens in this type of situation? So again, ultimately, again, they'll reach some type of agreement. But the first step in dealing with this conflict is to understand where the other one comes from. So the husband understands, okay, I get it. I understand why your family might have gone with this idea of using paper plates during the week. After all, again, there's so much going on during the week. Maybe you came from a big family. There was always so much going on, not enough time for setting up, for cleaning up. This was the best way to have the meal, maximize family time, but no one has to get stuck in the kitchen. No one has to get stuck setting up the table. Fine. And a wife could say, I see where you're coming from. I think it's beautiful that in your family, they wanted to make every meal something meaningful and something special. Not for us. We're not doing that. But I understand where it is that you're coming from. Familial differences are part and parcel of marriage, right? No matter how much you love your spouse's family, one thing is clear, which is, come on, someone's got to say it. They're not yours, right? They're not your family, right? And there's always, right? There's always that moment where I say, oh, thank God they're not my family, right? they're not my family. And that's okay, by the way. You see, sometimes we create unfair expectations that like my spouse's family is supposed to be just as close to me or as loving to me as my own family. If that happens, that's great. But you don't need that to have a beautiful and happy and successful marriage. The goal is to be able to coexist, and the goal is to be able to respect, and the goal is to be able to see where the other is coming from. So in this area of marital conflict, appreciating differences in family, again, the same way that in the first area of conflict, which is just the gender conflict, it becomes about understanding that your spouse thinks differently than you and respecting and accepting that. In the second category of differences in familial upbringing, same idea, accept the fact that you come from two different worlds, two different homes, two different families, and learn to respect. You don't have to agree, but learn to respect the manner in which your spouse was brought up. Number three, the third area of conflict is deficiencies. When we discover the deficiencies within our spouses, this is often the most difficult area of conflict for one simple reason. What every husband and what every wife wants to know more than anything is what? That the person they married is perfect. That's the ideal, right? Isn't that the fairy tale, right? That ultimately, again, we grow up with. I want to marry someone who's going to sweep me off my feet. Someone who's going to love me, care about me, make me the center of their universe, is going to have no character flaws, no deficiencies, is going to know what I want before I even know that I want it, right? Is going to be so in tuned with me that ultimately, again, they know everything about me, everything I need, and anything that I need in order to be happy. And then we get married and we discover that could happen. That could happen, but that takes a lifetime of work. And then more acutely is we discover the deficiencies within our spouses. So in the realm of deficiencies, we could break down deficiencies, character deficiencies in our spouses into two different categories. One, deficiencies that my spouse has, and I possess those same deficiencies as well. So sometimes I'll identify something in my spouse, and I'll say, okay, you have that deficiency, but I can't be too judgmental about that. Why? I have the same thing. I have the same deficiency as well. So those are a little bit easier to deal with. Because again, in general, if I could give myself a pass on something, I could give you a pass on the same thing. The area of conflict usually comes up in the second category, where my spouse possesses deficiencies that I don't have, or at least I think I don't have, right? Deficiencies that I don't have. I discover my spouse, and whatever it is, there's no need to, you could fill in the blank, whatever it is. My spouse has this certain deficiency. I happen not to have that deficiency. I have many others. But now that deficiency that my spouse has is so glaring. It's so glaring. And it's upsetting. And it angers me. Because why aren't you doing anything about it? Because a lot of times, remember, it's much easier to see an imperfection in someone else than it is for a person to be able to see their own imperfections. This we all know, right? This is human behavior 101. I could spot someone else's imperfection at a mile away. My own, I could go through an entire lifetime. And that's why, again, it's very difficult because sometimes even when people we love point things out to us, we're so resistant to accept. So for a variety of different reasons, not a discussion tonight. But in the second category of deficiencies, where I discover something in my spouse, that a deficiency that I don't possess, and again, it's staring me in the face. And sometimes it's amplified when I don't feel that my spouse is doing anything to remedy it. You're not working on it. You're not addressing it. Why aren't you helping yourself so that we could be better? You could be better. It's staring me. It's the elephant in the room. And still you're not doing anything about it. So a lot of times, what ends up happening under these types of circumstances is resentment grows and grows and grows. So Rabbi Neuberger says something quite beautiful. You take a look at number 8. He says, "Va'itzel azeh he shehari kol echad yodeh b'maras nafsho va'anu b'kiyim v'yodim b'chesronos atzmenu v'yafal pikin ein anu avudim u'shvurim kol kach mehem d'zehu teva ha'adam." I'm going to read one more line and I'll translate. "V'im kein Hayim yesh baze yashrus umidas emes lihios shavur odos chesronas ha'acher va'af api shapi rov yesh lo adam teirutzim al zeh sha'omrim la'atzmino dein chisaron shavano shalach chesronas ha'acher." So Rabbi Neuberger says something very amazing. He says that at the end of the day, we are very often forgiving of our own shortcomings and mistakes, right? How do you live with yourself? All of us have incredible mistakes and shortcomings. So how do we live with ourselves? We forgive ourselves. We forgive ourselves. We give ourselves a little bit of a pass. And by the way, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. Otherwise, you would be filled with self-loathing. So sometimes you have to give. I'm a human being. I have frailties. I have shortcomings. I have faults. I have negative character traits. But I also have a lot of good. There's a lot of positive in me as well. So I give myself a little bit of a pass. I'm not going to beat myself up over everything. Fantastic. The same pass you give to yourself, you also need to give to your spouse. Whatever mode of behavior you're going to apply to yourself, ultimately apply that to your spouse as well. You're going to give yourself a pass. You're going to say, I'm a human being. What could I do? I have limitations. I have faults. I have frailties. And that is the correct approach for dealing with your faults before you address them. Give your significant other that same pass as well. So when I discover that moment that my spouse is not perfect, and they have not one, not two, but perhaps even more deficiencies, shortcomings, and faults, it's tempting to pounce, especially when those are deficiencies and faults that I don't have myself. Rabbi Neuberger writes, the same way that you give yourself a little bit of a pass, give the other a little bit of a pass as well. And then he goes on and he says something amazing. Take a look at number 9. So in his model, which I think is a very profound one, is we're breaking up marital conflict into 3 primary categories. Once again, inherent differences between men and women, family differences or differences in familial upbringing and background, and personality differences. So again, when it comes to gender differences, accept and understand. When it comes to family differences, accept and understand. When it comes to deficiencies, so the deficiencies that your spouse possesses that you do not possess, give them, at least for a little while, the same lenient treatment you give yourself for your own deficiencies. Give them a little bit of a pass at first, not forever, because at the end of the day, we all have to get our act together in order to make our marriages thrive. But at least initially discovering it, give them a little bit of a pass. Look at number 9. Uklal gadol tzarech ladas b'yinisuin. So I thought we were going to cover much more tonight, but we may actually end up off with this and continuing with the rest of this section of Mir Hashem next week. He says something amazing. Because what I really wanted, I wanted to spend the rest of the evening on was the concept of conflict resolution. Because I think from this first approach, from Rabbi Neuberger's approach, you have 3 basic approaches to dealing with the 3 categories of conflict. And it's pretty much rooted in understand and accept, give a pass, right? Give lenient treatment. But then he says something amazing. Number 9. There's something very important to understand in the context of marriage. She'in tafkid habal. Listen to these words. She'in tafkid habal letakin chesronos ishto. V'chein lehefech in tafkid ha'isha letakin chesronos baila. It is not the job of a husband to fix his wife. Nor is it the job of a wife to fix her husband. So what do we do? Right? What else is left to do if our job is not to fix each other? So he says, Ella, kol adam tzarech lasok betikun atzmo. Successful marriage is not how much you could change the other. Successful marriage is how much you could change yourself. How much can you better yourself? He goes on. He says, "Kimo shakaser Rabbeinu Yona, lavos mishnah Rabbeinu Yona writes on Pirkei Avos." The Hillel said, "Di'im ein anili mili." Right? Hillel said, "If I am not for myself, then who is for me?" And the Rabbeinu Yona writes, "Im lo achiach atzmi shazari zatzmi mitzos mili lo achiach ulo zirzoni ki zirus acherim tofu lefisha." So he goes on, he says something really amazing. What is the avoda of marriage? And with this, I'm going to close out tonight's shir. What is the essence of marriage? Or how do you build a success? So we've identified conflict. We've gone ahead and identified some strategies for dealing with conflict. But at its core, how do you build a successful marriage? So I think what Rabbi Neuberger is highlighting is so often we're putting all of our efforts in the wrong direction. I'm figuring out how to fix you. You're figuring out how to fix me, but if you would plow your efforts inward, and I would also divert my efforts inward, I would make myself better, and you would make yourself better, then suddenly it doesn't mean to say all of our problems disappear. But a lot of them do. So many times in life when we encounter conflict, you know what the great unspoken secret of conflict is? Do you know why? And I don't know the number. It's just a hunch. And I would say 8 out of 10 times people get into conflict. Do you know why at the end of the day? Because they're not happy with themselves. Meaning, if you know truly happy people, they have very little conflict in their lives. For one simple reason, they don't need to pick on the shortcomings of others because I'm happy with who I am. I wish you much hatzlacha in your life, but I don't need to pick on your shortcomings to make myself feel better. I'm doing a good job on lifting myself up. Their disposition and their outlook in the world is dramatically different. When you are happy with who you are, and you are happy with the life you are leading, and you know that your existence is purposeful, and you know that you're working on maximizing your potential, your conflict level dramatically decreases. Mashenkin, as opposed to when you see people hyper-focused on fixing other people, whenever you see hyper-focused on fixing other people, they're doing one thing. They'll never admit it, but what are they really doing? They're running away from the true work they have to do, which is fixing themselves. Because it is so much easier for me to tell you what you have to do. I'll tell you exactly what you have to do. I'm going to give it to you in order of least important to most important. You want it that way. You want it alphabetical, chronological. Here's where I think you should start. Here's where I think you should end. I could give you your whole life plan. My life plan? Let's not talk about that. Right? It's much easier to speak about how we're going to fix you. And so many times in marriage, conflict comes about because a husband is trying to fix a wife and a wife is trying to fix a husband. And that's not the avoda in marriage. You want to be a good wife? Bolster yourself spiritually. Bolster yourself emotionally. Make sure that you are maximizing your potential. Make sure that the life that you're leading is a meaningful one. The things you're spending your time on are purposeful. Make sure you're inspiring your children if you're privileged to have children. Make sure the home that you're building ultimately, again, is a home that is filled with Kedusha. You want to be an inspired husband? You have to daven with a minyan. You want to be an inspired husband? You have to go ahead and carve out time to learn Torah every single day. You want to be an inspired husband? You have to engage in chesed, not to the detriment of your family, not neglecting everything else. Balance everything. A wife has to be balanced. A husband has to be balanced. But it's an incredible thing. We're so focused on all of the things we need to do. You have to do this to make it good. I have to do this to make it good. I have a great plan. You make the best version of you. I'll make the best version of me, and those two versions are going to have a magnificently blissful marriage. But if I spend my marriage trying to fix you, and you spend your marriage trying to fix me, then ultimately, again, not only will it not be blissful, but chas v'shalom, there will be a marriage filled with strife, filled with contention, filled with incredible animosity and anger. So we're going to stop over here for this week, and the Mir Hashem next week, what we're going to do in our final class, as we're going to focus again on conflict resolution, this time using some of Dr. Gottman's principles. And we'll use those principles. Again, we're dealing with what he calls different types of problems, perpetual problems, solvable problems. We'll get into that whole construct in Mir Hashem next week. And then, God willing, end off with a section about communication as we close out our Shalom Bayis series. Thank you again. There is Myriv in the small base madrash for whoever needs it.
8:55.